Hello, everybody, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you, wherever you may be. This is Bruce Ash, along with our co-host, Eb Wilkinson, welcoming you to this sunny and brisk fall Saturday to a special Law and Order edition of Inside Track. As always, thank you so much for supporting our great Inside Track sponsors, Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, and Corzon Cabinets. These are great local companies you should do business with. Now, talking about companies you should be doing business with, Corzon Cabinets is your locally owned source for high-quality kitchen, bath, and office cabinets. Joy, Jennifer, and David can help design your dream kitchen, office, or bath area. Corzon Cabinets carries J&K, Conestoga, and now Yorktown Cabinets. Come by and visit the showroom soon. See our displays of what your home will look like with Corzon Cabinets. And you know, we're one of the few suppliers of Yorktown Cabinets anywhere in Southern Arizona. Call 488-2266. That's 488-2266. Let them know you heard this ad on Inside Track to receive an additional 5% discount on Corzon's already low wholesale prices. You'll be amazed by the great styles and super, super low prices at Corzon Cabinets. Ed, it's great to see you.
Good to see you, Bruce.
So, you know, what you guys don't know is in his spare time, you know, doing that investment thing and his NRA thing, you know, Eb is like tearing his house apart, blowing it up.
It's incredible.
Blowing it up. Everything going okay?
Going well. Got flooring in, ready to source some cabinets out now.
Oh, good. And doors are up or not?
Doors are up.
Good, good.
So I got to stop by and see Corzon and
they'll take
them some measurements.
They'll take very good care of you. So, you know, we're going to kind of keep track of this, you know, this ongoing saga.
Have you seen the movie The Money Pit?
So. Well, they always say get three bids, okay, but when you're remodeling, you get three bids, you take the low one and multiply it times three, and that's what you come up
exactly.
with. All right. Well, keep us posted.
It just is.
It's a process. Yeah. Here's an Inside Track heads up today. The 34th Pima County Sheriff Mark Napier will join us for the entire hour today. We invite your calls and questions, comments for the sheriff on the Imus Wilkinson Live Line 790-2040. All callers welcome to call in. We are having some technical difficulties. Sorry about that. I can't control weird stuff going on the phone, but hopefully, if you have a question, you'll be able to call in. Our show will be live again for next week, our Thanksgiving show next Saturday. We'll talk to Jean Fettigan from Sister Jose Women's Homeless Shelter, Tianne Kennedy with Gap Ministries, and Onita Davis with Wreaths Across America. We're going to discuss all the ways that we can share our bounty with others and come together as a community in the Thanksgiving holiday. In the following weeks, we'll feature Dr. Bob Branch on how to run for office in Arizona, plus a few surprises from my upcoming trip to Washington, D.C. Inside Track veteran and good friend Tom Danahy will return before the new year for us to grade our mutual 2019 predictions. Should be a fun show. I think you're going to be very surprised by some of our predictions. Eb, Tom, and I will make our 2020 predictions. I think the winner should be awarded a chance to take the losers out to lunch. So I hope Tom is listening and he'll agree to be a participant. Tom, I know you're going to win. So, you know, not Popeyes, though. Something other than Popeyes. When we return from the break, Pima County Sheriff Mark Napier will join us for an update. We have a great show for you this afternoon. Stay tuned, Inside Track. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Inside Track. This is Bruce. Eb is right across from me, and also across from me and joining us for the entire show is Pima County Sheriff Mark Napier. Thanks for joining us, Sheriff Napier.
I'm happy to be here. I got to give a shout out to my wife. She usually listens. Honey, I hope you're enjoying your errands. I love you, and I'll be home soon. We'll get to see our new grandson.
Okay, so Mark is dressed in uniform. If Emil Franzi was sitting in this chair... He would be spitting across the table here and like, oh, you guys wearing your four stars and, you know, what the hell's going on? And, you know, why? He hated that. And I'll never forget when Emil at the end of his life, we were in the hospital room together, and in comes Mark. And if Abel could have jumped up out of the bed and strangled you, he would have.
No, you called me and said, you know, you need to come and see Emil, and I said, oh, I will. And you go, don't wear your four stars. And I said, oh, you got to be kidding me! I'm absolutely going to wear my four stars because I want him to get one more shot at me, and he sure did. And you're right; if he could have got out of that bed and strangled me, if I could have found seven or eight stars to make it look like a dog collar, I would have done it because we all loved Emil, and he definitely had a lot of personality.
Yeah, he did.
He was a character.
Yeah. He didn't like for personality. So the other part of the attire today is Mark is packing. Okay, this is a sheriff. You know, this guy, he's a real lawman. This isn't some wussy boy, you know, who never did this, some pencil pusher. This guy's a real lawman. And
brand new weapon, too, a Smith & Wesson MP Series 2.0.
Oh, did you just get the new one?
Yeah, I did. And it shoots really good. I shot 200 rounds through that Pima pistol yesterday. It's a good weapon. It's got a fluted barrel and a fluted slide, so it doesn't have a lot of muzzle raise. I'm still trying to get used to the high-vis sights. Mm-hmm. I'm used to the blacked-out sight in the back and the high-vis in the front. But
what kind of trigger pull on it?
Smith & Wesson won't like this. I think it's kind of a mediocre trigger pull. I have a Smith or a 6-hour P320 that has a very good trigger pull. This you kind of get spoiled. So this is not, this is a little bit on the sloppy side.
Well, what's the caliber?
It's a 9mm. Just easier to shoot. I was carrying a 1911 45
for a long
time.
I was going to say, last time I saw you, you were carrying the 1911.
Well, it's kind of like Emil and the Stars. If you go to a sheriff's conference and you're holding a plastic gun, you get a lot of crap. Everybody has their 1911.
And you should, for crying out loud.
You know, but it's come time that probably a 9mm suits me better right now.
You know, my favorite sidearm is my Navy SEAL. My 9. Oh, my God. That is just the sweetest gun. It is like drinking a bottle of wine. It's just boom. Boom. Great gun. And I mean, I can't shoot it enough. It's just, it's awesome.
I've got one. It's great. But coming from the Marine Corps side, it's a 1911.
Yeah, no, mm-hmm. And I
which
love,
is why my phone number ends in 1911.
Yeah. I mean, I got three different, 1911s. I love them. But, you know, over a period of time, first of all, it holds a lot more ammo, which is nice, you know. But I just, the feel of the gun, you know, and it's a real gun. It's not that plastic crap.
Oh, they're I have one. They're great guns.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a 9mm on a 1911 platform, and it shoots really good. I mean, the trigger pull on it's very, very good and all that, but it's not reliable. It tends to have a lot of feedway malfunctions. I don't know if the return spring's a little too heavy or what, but it tends to have some more malfunctions than I would like.
Well, you don't need any.
No, one's too many. I have an AR-15 that's really decked out. I put a new trigger in that. I've got an Aimpoint Pearl Patrol sight, a red dot on that, and that thing is a fantastic rifle. But I would like to get a 308 platform. And as Marlene's listening, and honey, the reason is when the zombie apocalypse comes, how close do you want them to get to us, baby? I mean, we've got to take them out at about 500 yards.
Why wait till they're that close?
Yeah, that's it, honey.
Get the M82.
See, Eb is backing me up on this, baby. So it's not just me and my love.
Every
of guns.
Sheriff needs a 50 cal.
Oh,
right,
no.
All right. Look, Mark, you were elected in 2016. You defeated a short time incumbent who had been appointed by a 35-year incumbent when he retired, with basically one man running the sheriff's office for so long. You had a lot to fix.
Well, I wouldn't say fix so much as there were a lot of things that we just needed to retool. Culture's one thing. Fiscal responsibility was a big thing, because when I took office on January 1st, 2017, my staff came to me and said, we've got a lot of problems, Sheriff. And I said, oh, this is great.
Yeah,
and,
but you knew going into it.
I knew we had problems, but I will say I did not understand the depth of the problems that we had. Because looking from the outside, you only see the surface of the problems. Once you get in and you start digging, you really see the depth of the problems. And the depth kind of surprised me. But we were about 6 million, tracking about 6 million in the red when I took office. I told Huckleberry that we would reduce that by 50% my first 6 months, which we were successful in doing that. There was some pain involved, but there always going to be. And then we finished the last two fiscal years more than $5 million in the black, which is uncommon for a public entity to do that. And then we worked to leverage.
Do you get credited for that in the next budget, or do you have to give it away?
No, I give it back to the general fund, but I leverage that goodwill toward compensation increases for my staff, and that's where it went. I don't have a savings account, unlike a private business where you can carry forward. I can't do that. I've got to give it back to the general fund. But what I do is leverage that toward doing some things with compensation, and Huckleberry's kept his word about that. The first year, we turned back about $5 million back to the general fund, but I got $4.8 million in raises for the deputies. So it was almost a return swap on that.
So what your total budget is what?
It's $159 million.
And your salaries and compensation amounts?
It's about, roughly speaking, 85%. And that's pretty common in a law enforcement agency.
Oh, sure.
It's about 85%. The other problem, Bruce, is that the remaining 15%, a lot of that is not discretionary, meaning that we have to put gas in cars, we've got to have bullets, we've got to do a lot of things. So that 15%, very little of that is discretionary. So when you want to affect your budget, you're always going to look on the personnel services side. And see what you can do there to save a little money. And then when the staff gets raises, that's not built into my budget during the next year. It's formalized the following year. So I've got to absorb those salary additions in that next budget cycle.
So what would you say the one thing so far that needed fixing that you're proudest of? Would it be the budget and how you've, you know, gone from deficit to surplus, or what else? I mean, because you had lots of things that you needed to futz with.
Well, I think that a combination of things, and I think if you say there's one thing you lack focus especially as a law enforcement leader, because there isn't one thing, there's a lot of things. I think we've done some good with compensation. We needed to raise the bottom up for corrections officers and deputies because we were not marketplace competitive. We were not recruiting. Now we are. So staffing has turned the corner. We're able to recruit. We're doing a little bit better on the retention side. We still got some work to do with compensation. It'll be a moving target forever. You're never going to fix compensation completely. But we're working in a good direction there. Staffing and recruiting, we should be at full staffing in the jail by shortly after the first of the year, which I did not think was possible. That's good. We should be near full staffing in the field by early this spring. Another thing that seemed impossible 24 months ago.
How understaffed are you?
Well, it's a moving target every day, but I would say we're probably at about roughly 92% staffing in the field and probably a similar number in corrections.
And then over the next 12 months, how many do you know of that are going to rotate out and retire?
Well, I've authorized us to overhire because we know, I think it's 5 will rotate out with a retirement. They have fixed dates, so we're going to actually overhire to take care of those because we're going to have enough bodies to potentially do that. The problem was we could want to do anything. We just didn't have the bodies come into the door.
Right.
So I had money to hire, but we didn't have bodies to hire, and I'm not going to reduce our standards to, you know, grab the people just to put bodies in seats.
So when you hire them for the field, you're getting people that are not post-certified.
That's correct. It's about a year to train between the academy and field training to get somebody out there functioning as a deputy. And then it still takes, in my opinion, about another 4 years before you get somebody that's really competent. At about the 5-year mark, a law enforcement officer is kind of experienced enough to be competent, autonomous, but it takes about that long. It's a very complicated job.
So what portion of the force has been there for 5 years or more?
Well, that's hard to say because we have about 500 in corrections, about 500 on the sworn side. So we actually have a lot of senior deputies. I mean, when we looked at compensation, about half of our deputies were above the posted salary range. So we got a lot of tenured people. What there's kind of a, it's weird. There's a lot of people on the front side of the compensation side, and there's a lot of people on the back side, and there's a little void in the middle, and we're trying to do some things on their compensation to help them out as well.
So you've come under fire recently from the sheriff's union, if you will, their association, or deputies association, I should say. What's the story?
Well, they're unhappy about their compensation, and I understand that, and they're worked up about that. And I've told them personally, my son's a cop, and I've been a cop since 1981, so I'm not lacking empathy in the cause of your compensation. But I don't set your compensation, and we've done some good work there. But they're convinced that somehow I can just arbitrarily set their pay range, which I don't have the authority to do, and they're upset because the STEP program went away. Well, it's a documented fact that went away before I became sheriff. And I don't have the authority to reinstate it. Certainly the Board of Supervisors does. If tomorrow the Board of Supervisors said every deputy should make $60 an hour, if they put that money in my budget, I'm happy for them. I'm content. So they're angry, and they got to be angry at somebody. And they filed a vote of no confidence against Dupnik, and then one against Nanos, and now one against me. And I believe if the pattern does not get interrupted, if it's Sheriff Jones after me, this will be a repeat.
So you know, obviously, I mean, we know it takes three votes of the Board of Supervisors to make these decisions on salaries or budget. But that doesn't mean that you've given up.
No.
I mean, you're working back channel. So I mean, can you explain a little how that works?
Because, sure.
Because I know, you know, you stand up for your deputies.
Absolutely. To give you an example, when I took office, a starting deputy was making $20.85 an hour. Today, that same deputy makes $26.01 an hour. That's more than a 24% raise. That was championed by me. The association, none of the representative bodies submitted any pay plan. None. Zero. Zip. So had I done nothing, nothing would have happened other than the COLA, which was 2%. We've normalized the top of the range, so there's still some range for the more senior deputies to advance. When I took office, a starting corrections officer was making $17.52 an hour. Today, that same person makes $21.50 an hour. We had to raise the bottom because we were not marketplace competitive. Had I not done that, our staffing model would look horrific right now. We would be in a crisis mode because we could not attract people in at $20.85 an hour as a deputy. We were not competitive in the marketplace. At $26, we are competitive. So you have to raise the bottom first to get butts in the door, and then you have to start nipping away at taking care of the people that are there. But keep in mind, Bruce, that I've been sheriff for almost 3 years. I've had two bites at the apple. Two budgets that I own. I've had two chances to fix this. That's it. And I know they're impatient, but we need a couple of budget cycles to normalize the pay range and then to set a pay plan in effect, because right now there is no pay plan, and we need to fix that.
So are the supervisors, do you think, are they empathetic and interested in helping out? I mean, obviously public safety is maybe the most important part of the county's operations.
Well, I would argue that you show me a good community with a bad law enforcement agency. They don't exist. So I say that we need to channel a lot of money. Here's another one. I get tired of this. How many people would like to drive on a good road to a dangerous neighborhood? Nobody. So I hear about roads all the time, and we need to first have safe neighborhoods. And the deputies.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because as I was, you know, formulating some questions to talk about today, I thought to myself about the roads, and I said, you know, if I'm a sheriff, and you know, you're driving a lot of new vehicles or newer vehicles, which is a good thing, but if I'm driving down a road that's got all kinds of, you know, problems. How, I mean,
that's Pima County,
and I'm doing 75 miles an hour, maybe. Okay, I mean, that's got to be taking a tremendous risk. You know, maybe a greater risk than when you finally get to the call.
Yeah, there are a lot of factors that need attention. I think this pay-as-you-go plan, it passed 5-0 from the Board of Supervisors. That seems to have merit. But we also need to think about long-term planning for the compensation of public safety. And it is different. And the problem is we've always take this Me Too approach, where somehow we treat a landscaper the same way as a deputy or a corrections officer. There is not a Me Too approach here. It's marketplace different. The tasks are completely different. So we need to approach those differently. But what I'd like is a commitment from the Board of Supervisors to support a pay plan and then to normalize it in the budget moving forward.
Define what you mean by normalize.
Is to the commitment to know that if we're going to have classifications that a deputy could move between, we reasonably know that there are, for example, 50 people that could move from classification A to B. We know what that'll cost. So just build that into my budget, and that normalizes it. Rather than getting to this fight every year about what scraps are left and then try to piecemeal those out, that's not a plan. Let's have a plan. Let's normalize it in the budget, and then we can plan out 5, 6, 7 years in advance and know how much compensation increases we'll have to fund with the budget. And that makes it so much easier to plan that than this, okay, we haven't done anything for them for 10 years. Now we're going to spend $3 million. Well, you got to come up with that $3 million rather than say, let's do the right thing, and every year we'll put $1 million into the Sheriff's Department's budget for, I'm making those numbers up off right. the top of my head, but $1 million or whatever it takes to keep those people moving in the compensation scale.
So that's just the strategic planning process.
Yes, and that's another thing we didn't have when I took office at the Sheriff's Department. I met with my senior command staff after I'd been there about a year, and I said, tell me where we'll be in 3 or 5 years. And it was like deer in the headlights. And I said, guys, getting to 5 o'clock every day and not messing anything up too badly is not a strategic plan. So now we have a strategic plan. We at least know what we're working toward. People criticize me because I take this on as more of a business approach. I am a cop. I've been a cop a long time. I'm a decorated cop. I can do cop things. I'm right now running a very big business. The Sheriff's Department is a big business. I employ 1,500 people, have a $159 million budget. I have a service area of 9,200 square miles. What I should have now is cop sense but business acumen. And that's what I bring to this position is I understand budgets, understand personnel management, and that's what I'm doing right now is trying to manage a very big business.
Right, so if you had everything that you need right now and you had it right now, how much more are you going to need 5 years from now?
Well, that would depend on the plan. See, and that's the thing, Ed, but that we don't have a plan. So if we were to implement a plan that I've proposed to the association and the FOP, we could then track that. I could say with absolute confidence that 5 years from now, everything being as it is today, we will need an additional $295,000 to fund the plan, to keep people moving in that pay range, to keep the retention, keep our best people there. It becomes very easy to do if you have a plan. The problem is we don't have a plan right now.
All right.
All right, so we need to take a break.
This is flying by.
And I want you to think about this question, because it's going to be the first question we ask you coming back. If you had to grade yourself, don't say anything now, but if you had to grade yourself, how would you mark the overall grade to Sheriff Mark Napier after approximately 3 years in office? So when we come back, we'll start with that. Stay tuned. You're listening to Inside Track. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Inside Track. Bruce Ash here with co-host Eb Wilkinson. Our special guest for the entire show today is Sheriff of Pima County, Mark Napier. So I'm gonna throw a little curve at you. If you had to grade yourself, how would you mark your overall grade at this time, and why? Plus, how do you think the voters who elected you sheriff would grade your success?
Well, thank you for that, Bruce. That was a softball question. I would give myself a B, and I know that'll be used against me at some point, that he doesn't even rate himself as an A, but I'm a very pragmatic man. I've been a sheriff for 3 years. There's a learning curve associated with this. I need to learn county policies and develop relationships with county staff that I had not already developed, better assess where the department is, and provide that direction. So there's a learning curve, learning people and things that you get better at over time. I think I'm a far better sheriff this year than I was the second year or the first year. That's natural. That's what should happen. I think with respect to community outreach, I'd give myself a solid A. We're more involved in the community than we ever have been. I'm very proud of that. Organizational management, I'd give us a solid A minus on that. We made great strides there as well. I've been recognized by my peers. I've been elected to be the vice president of the Arizona Sheriff's Association, and I'll be in January the vice president of Major County Sheriffs of America. Sit on the executive board of the Arizona Joint Terrorism Task Force. Also, I'm on the executive committee and the vice chair for Arizona HIDA. I sit as a member of the Unified Command for the Alliance to Combat Transnational Threats. So I'm very involved and acknowledged by my peers as one of the leaders, not only locally and at the state level, but nationally as a sheriff. In 3 years, that's a pretty solid accomplishment. Major County Sheriffs is limited to the 100 largest sheriffs in the United States, and they've elected me to be their vice president. That's never happened in Pima County before. We had an entourage or a delegation from the Department of Homeland Security here yesterday visiting my department to try to learn about border issues. I've traveled around the country to try to better inform other sheriffs and law enforcement leaders about what we're really facing here on the border. So in that outreach, I'd say there's a solid A. But overall, I think a B, and I'm always working very hard.
And working, yeah.
I'm always working hard to improve that.
So you talked about the border just a second ago. We saw this huge influx of illegal traffic coming into this country in 2019. And we've also had probably equally as high amount of drugs coming into the country, because part of this whole human smuggling thing is a diversion for drug and other types of smuggling, you know, back and forth across the border. What sort of impact has that had in 2019 on your department and your ability to govern, to enforce the laws and so on?
Well, I would say that when I talk to groups outside of our area, I would say that I've been a cop since 1981. I never thought I would see the day when deputies, law enforcement officers, would carry medicine on their person in the same manner they carry a flashlight or a ballpoint pen, but we're now carrying Narcan to save people on overdoses. If that doesn't tell you we have a crisis in this country right now, I cannot help you. I mean, that is a very telling visual picture. I think we saved 9 lives by administering Narcan on my department. The influx of opiates and methamphetamine is not talked about at all, but that is the real problem. We need to focus on that. It's not being cooked locally. It's coming up from the South. It's being cooked in Mexico. So there is a tremendous public safety issue with respect to the lack of security on our southern border. There's also a national security concern, because we're not trying to avoid having people fly planes into buildings anymore. That's not the terrorism threat. The terrorism threat today, I dare say, is somebody that snuck across the border 6 months ago who just rented a U-Haul truck and intends to ride into the Altuerde, Tucson. It's a very unsophisticated threat. It's a lone wolf threat. So we can't have a lack of security on our southern border, because it is a national security concern. And then lastly, it's a human rights tragedy. The victimization of migrants as they come up from the desert, both criminally, sexually, financially, is horrific. And the intertwined nature of that with the drug cartels who control the plazas, which are ingress points in the United States, if they're not directly involved in human smuggling, they're profiteering from it to extraordinary lengths. Some studies say that maybe there's more money in human trafficking now than drug trafficking. So we have a significant national security problem that requires thoughtful and strategic dialogue to fix. I'm so aggravated that for 32 years I've been in this valley, one administration after another has been telling us that they're going to secure the border, they're going to do something about this. My fear is that some sheriff sitting here 30 years from now saying we ought to do something about this.
So on the issue of drug enforcement and handling this influx of traffic that we have in southern Arizona, Stone Garden had been really a yearly, just a kind of a consent agenda approval. A year ago, there was this big mess with it. They passed something, the Board of Supervisors passed something in May, but they added a component with respect to humanitarian aid, and that's what's holding up, as I understand, the receipt of those funds. But the county is spending all of those funds as if they're getting the humanitarian aid through the Stone Garden. Is that really fair of the county to do? I mean, it hurts. It seems like it really hurts your ability to for law enforcement.
Well, it has stalled the grant now for more than 6 months. So for 6 months, I've not been able to put boots on the ground with overtime to address transnational crime threats coming up from the border. That is a problem. I would support the county's position in that we do need to do some humanitarian aid, because as asylum seekers are released into our community, we still have an affirmative responsibility to provide care for these people. Otherwise, they become victims of crime or participants in crime out of necessity. So we have an affirmative responsibility when they're released into the community to do something, and that requires humanitarian aid. So I do support that. They put that codicil on the approval of the grant. And who
put that codicil on?
The Board of Supervisors.
Okay. The Democratic members of the Board of Supervisors.
Well, they had a majority vote, so it is the Board of Supervisors. As late as yesterday afternoon, Friday afternoon, I was in discussions with people in Washington, D.C., trying to move this forward. They're reticent to give us humanitarian aid in what is an operational grant. The other problem is that sheriffs have been going, and I know because I've been in the White House, saying we need a third rail of funding because we have to address these other collateral costs associated with the lack of security on the border. Well, they heard us. They actually put in House Bill 3401, sent $30 million out to address these issues. So part of the holdup in Washington, D.C. is they say, Sheriff, you're trying to take two bites at the same apple. You're trying to take money out of Stone Garden Grant, which is an operational grant for humanitarian aid. At the same time, you're applying for exactly what you sheriffs have been asking us for, which is the third rail of funding. So I'm not sure right now where that'll all end up at, but it has taken a tremendous amount of my time to try to keep this alive in Washington, D.C., because I think they've said no to me 10 times.
So how much more funding do you need?
Well, I'd like to have the funding that we've been awarded, which is about $2 million, roughly speaking, $1 million in overtime and $1 million for equipment. And then our 2019 grant, which is sitting there with money to be spent, is stalled because we can't get past the 2018 grant. You know what most communities say when the government comes and says, hey, we'll give you $2 million? They say, thank you. That's it, and we're done.
So let's be clear. Let's be clear on that supervisor's vote. There were three votes to approve the Stone Garden grant, the acceptance of it. Steve Christie, Allie Miller voted for it, as well as Sharon Bronson. But the guys who really kind of muck this thing up are Valadez and Elias, as well as Sharon, because putting that codicil in has really, you're almost back in the same situation we were in 2018.
Well, we've created more of a problem there than we needed to. What we needed to do is address the community concerns with respect to acceptance of the grant, which we could do, and I've shown a great propensity, a willingness to do. So where there are legitimate concerns, we'll address those things. And there are legitimate concerns. I get it. I understand that. But to hold the grant up or hold it hostage or make it a political spectacle is not the right way to address the issue. I think we could address this community issue without doing that with the grant money, because now for the last 6 months, we've not had boots on the ground trying to address these transnational crime threats in our county. And there's a cost to that. Every drug that we don't interdict, every time we don't find a migrant in the desert that's, you know, being victimized or dies at the hands of the environment, there is a collateral cost associated with this. And I wish we could move this forward and get it out of the political arena, put it back in the public safety arena, and then address community concerns in that arena. That's the right way to do it.
Mm-hmm. So let's move to something that was in the news here recently. The Star and others have reported that a deputy arrest incident at Vision Quest involving a quadriplegic. Can you respond to that? I'm sure there's some things you can't talk about, but let us know what you can talk about in terms of that arrest.
Well, a week ago, we were notified by a media outlet that the media outlet had a disturbing video. And they presented that to us late Wednesday afternoon. We viewed the video at least tentatively that afternoon, and then in detail Thursday. I met with my command staff, my executive team, had them review it. By that time, the criminal charges against the quadruple amputee had been already dropped by the Pima County Attorney's Office. We saw some things in the video that we felt were concerning. So we did the right thing. On Friday morning, I requested that a criminal investigation be undertaken to determine what happened. Not predisposed to believing or bowing to community concern, but there's enough on that video to cause concern that we needed to launch an investigation to determine what happened. Commensurate with that criminal investigation being launched, we put the deputy on administrative leave, which is common practice. So until that criminal investigation comes back and those findings are presented to the county attorney's office, we're in a holding pattern. And I really think that's exactly what the community and my department would expect of me, is to not take a knee-jerk response to anything, take a measured response, a thoughtful response, but then promptly act. I still have the issue of due process rights for my deputy. He has due process rights both statutorily and within county policy, and I still need to be responsive to the community concerns. So those things have to be balanced.
But him and his attorney are claiming foul against you and your administration at this time, saying that you're not supporting your deputies.
I'm absolutely supporting my deputy. What you support your deputy not by ignoring something that there's significant community concern about. You support the deputy by engaging in an investigation to determine what happened. Let's put this to rest. And so that's what we've done. He's on paid administrative leave until we get done with a criminal investigation. We'll present those findings to the county attorney's office. They'll make a determination about whether there's any criminal conduct there. That's exactly what they should expect us to do. I can't turn a blind eye to things on that video that are concerning. There could be an explanation for those things. That's possible. If so, the investigation will uncover that.
So this was sort of an unusual incident in terms of how I viewed it. The sheriff's deputy who was involved in the incident has basically been speaking out through his attorney and have kind of launched their own defense outside of the criminal investigation in the press. And that's sort of brings us to a whole new level, doesn't it?
Well, if I were advising them, and of course they never asked for my advice on that, I think that was a bad idea. You know, the concern about it was dying down a little bit. Let's let the investigative process run its course without stirring that up again. And I think doing that was counterproductive. But, you know, that person is seeking advice from their attorney. And they certainly have, under the First Amendment, the right to speak out. They have the right to due process, and I respect all those things.
When they're on administrative leave, paid administrative leave, are they just sitting at home?
Yes, okay. Pretty much just sitting at home. Yep.
Turning their gun and badge?
Yeah, we take the equipment. They're on paid administrative leave until we get results from the criminal investigation.
So let's talk about the evidence that exists in that. It comes through a body cam.
No, it's not.
Oh, it isn't? Oh.
No, it's not a body cam. It was a juvenile there that was recording it.
Oh, okay. All right. I misunderstood that. Do sheriffs in Pima County wear body cams?
No, they do not.
Why?
The expense associated with it. The body cams themselves are not expensive. It's the administration of the program that becomes very expensive because now you have to store all that video. Every public request for that video requires somebody to review it, redact out content in that video that shouldn't be seen. So there's a lot of collateral cost. I just don't have that in my budget right now. And I think the technology will continue to improve. I think we need to wait on that a little while.
So it is sort of interesting to note that with all of the interference that the Board of Supervisors has had with respect to how the sheriff's office is run, that they wouldn't have funded body cams.
Well, if they were to ask me, I'd say
they did this
clumsy
thing, and
yeah.
You know, I mean, they were meddling in your operations for a long time.
Well, if they were to ask me, I wouldn't recommend body cameras right now. I think the technology needs to continue to improve, and we need to develop a system to better administer the program once it's launched. I think every department that's launched this has realized that it costs a lot more to run it and administer it than they imagined. So I don't think that's the time right now.
But what about the before and after? I mean, obviously, when an incident is going on, but In the usual body cam operations, do you see the before as well as the after, you know, in terms of how an incident unfolds and how it, you know, ends up and so on?
Yeah, of course, you're going to see a broader range, but herein lies the problem. Let's say that you have 30 minutes of video that you watch all 30 minutes and it explains everything that the deputy did. You go, wow, looking at the entirety of the 30 minutes of video, it makes perfect sense. The news is not going to run 30 minutes of video. Mm-hmm. They're going to run the most inflammatory 20 seconds of video with no context at all.
if it bleeds, it leads.
You know, and you know, the news makes news. That's what they do. I don't begrudge them that. But sometimes when you look at something in the entire construct of how it happened, it's perfectly explainable. And you go, okay, now I get it. But you're not going to see that entire video.
Is our body cam, and I'm not advocating for body cams. I just think it's an interesting thing to talk about with respect to law enforcement. How effective are body cams in terms of court cases? the actual adjudication later on in these various incidents.
Well, I've heard and read studies that would suggest that about it's half the time the body camera exonerates an officer because there's an allegation there that is not substantiated by video or audio, that they both do video and audio. And then, you know, other times it inflames things because something, if you're looking at something and you don't have a trained eye for it and you don't understand how police operate, it looks really bad. because it's not taken in context of what our training is or what preceded that 20-second video clip that you're looking at. So it is a two-edged sword. There's a lot of cost involved, and I think the technology is going to continue to improve to the point where we'll be able to implement them at some point in the future, but it's just not right now.
So stop and frisk, broken windows, they sort of have a negative connotation with the public. Personally, I feel safer knowing we have a strong law enforcement presence versus crooks having the upper hand. The former mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg, recently was forced to apologize for the policies of the NYPD during his term as mayor. Do you think that the move away from strong law enforcement presence in communities has helped or hurt safety?
Well, there's a dividing line there. You can't just say stop and frisk without understanding whether there's a legal basis
to do that. And
so I think the problem is that sometimes there's extra legal activity surrounding stop and frisk. I certainly encourage my deputies to be very proactive while being constitutional in their pursuit of crime. And crime is down significantly in Pima County. It is. But it's kind of this dichotomous argument, Bruce, where you're either supporting stuff that constitutionally is very sketchy or you're not supporting aggressive law enforcement. I think you can do aggressive, very aggressive law enforcement, stay within the lane of being constitutionally within the bounds that we need to operate. And broken windows is a different thing than stop and frisk. They're not the same thing at all. Broken windows has absolute efficacy, undisputed in any arena, of looking at environmental factors that contribute to criminality, and that is well supported.
Well, and they made him apologize for that as well.
Yeah, I don't think there's any apology in an academic sense for what broken windows policing is really about. If you look back at it, I have a master's degree in criminal justice, so I understand broken windows policing. There's no reason to apologize for that. If there were extra legal activities that occurred surrounding stop and frisk, you may have some liability there.
Mm-hmm. But with the stop and frisk, one cannot deny that it was effective.
Well, I think you're going to not like this, but I think showing causality between one thing and another in a public sector environment is problematic, because there are always intervening variables that you cannot isolate out of the equation. That may make your head hurt, but
Did they take bad guys off the street?
They most certainly,
or move them to another place.
Right. Yeah, the displacement is another factor, but so yes, I think that you could argue, did it have a potentially positive impact on violent crime? Potentially, yes. There could be other factors that led to that. But I don't think we should ever, at the expense of constitutional protections, due process.
That's not what I'm saying.
You know what I'm saying, though. Yeah. I mean, if you can't go down that road.
So I want to change streams here a little bit. We only have about 3 minutes left in the show. On your corrections department, talk about that, because, you know, you read everywhere and you see these stories around with jails that, you know, there's just mass problems. What about Pima County? You're in charge of the county jail as well. That's part of your job.
That's the affirmative responsibility of a sheriff. We have a detention facility that has about 2,200 beds. And we
2,200 beds.
Yeah,
wow.
We have a population of daily about 1,900-ish.
Wow.
Now, given that population, given the strain of that population, both with mental health and substance abuse issues and everything, it's amazing that we do not have more problems than we do.
And what do you attribute that to? Because jails can be a very unsafe place for everybody.
I love the place, man. I've spent some time over there. Unlike most sheriffs, I spend some time in my jail. And we have great staff there. It doesn't mean they're always perfect or anything like that. No one should reasonably expect that. But we have a good command staff, good supervisors. Our staffing model's coming up so that we'll be able to administer the jail better than we have before. We need to be at full staffing. But those folks do a really good job in a very difficult environment. We have a good health care provider to do medical assisted treatment for people coming in there with drug abuse problems.
So how does that work? Who's providing that?
We outsource that to a company. Uh-huh. They come into the jail. The other thing that we implemented, and I know it sounds namby-pamby, but we put comfort dogs in the jail. And that does have a positive impact. I mean, when you pet a dog, I don't care who you are, it just calms you down. So we have therapy dogs that go through the jail. We're paying more attention to the mental health issues associated in that environment. So all those things together have helped us a lot. It doesn't mean that we won't have bumps in the road, but I think it's a very well-run facility.
So what's your chief number one goal in 2020, besides maybe running for re-election and winning an election? in the middle of all that, what is your chief goal to achieve in 2020?
Well, let me just back you up for a second. I'll in all likelihood run for office, but that doesn't, I want to be a good sheriff. And I think if you're a good sheriff, you don't worry about running for office. People will reelect you. They either will or they won't. But I'm going to keep doing what I do. I want to continue to work on compensation. I want to get somehow, and I don't know how to do it, to be honest, is get this animus out between the line level people and the sheriff. It doesn't serve the best interest of anybody. I've been working to try to build bridges there, but it's a very tough environment. Because they're so used to being on the fight, it's hard to get them off of that. So I'd like to work on that and continue with community outreach. That's another thing that's very important to me.
So I need to ask you a question. Crazy question, just real quick.
Yes.
What's your favorite cop show of all time?
Andy Griffith.
Andy Griffin. Oh, come on. Come on.
He was the sheriff. What did you think I was going to say?
I mean like
what
a real...
What about Blue Bloods?
Actually, Hill Street Blues was really good.
Yeah.
Hill Street Blues was a good cop show.
All right. Well, look, thanks very much for appearing.
Happy to be here,
my friend. I hope you can come back again soon.
Thank you.
Please continue to support all of our great Inside Track customers and sponsors. Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, Corzine Cabinets, and Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. These are great locally owned and run companies committed to our community you should do business with. Until next week for Inside Track, this is Bruce Ash.
And Eb Wilkinson.
And
Sheriff Mark Napier.
Hoping you all enjoy a peaceful and family-filled Thanksgiving and wishing you all a very pleasant good afternoon.